and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the statewide economic forecast luncheon hosted by the World Trade Center of Alaska. Recorded on January 22nd in Anchorage, we'll first hear a national and international economic update presented by Vice President and Senior Economist of Wells Capital Management, Gary Sloshberg. Stay tuned for the Alaska Economic Review and Forecast in the second half of the show.
Good afternoon and welcome to the 10th annual Statewide Economic Forecast Luncheon. Thank you very much for being here today. My name is Greg Wolf. I'm the Executive Director of World Trade Center Alaska, and we hope that you will join us each year at this time as we endeavor to provide a forecast for Alaska's economy, take a look at the global picture, as well as provide a report on Alaska's international exports, such a key part of the state's overall economy. This year, once again, we are conducting our forecast luncheons in Alaska's three largest communities, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. Last week, we were in Juneau and presented this event with our partner, the Juneau Chamber of Commerce. We had been scheduled to do Fairbanks last week, but as you know, they had what they called severe weather conditions, and it wasn't severely cold. It was actually severely warm, and it was pouring down rain, and fearing the worst on ice conditions and whatnot, a lot of the things were not done that week. So we've rescheduled for February the 5th, when I'm assured the weather will be beautiful. We have a very informative, insightful set of presentations, but before we get started, I'd like to introduce a few people. First, at the head table, on my far right, is Tony Follett, the president of Aerometric Alaska and chairman of the Export Council of Alaska. Next to Tony is Tom Case, the chancellor of the University of Alaska Anchorage. The university is one of our valued longtime strategic partners, and we appreciate their support. Next to Tom is Robbie Graham, the assistant commissioner of the State of Alaska's Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. The State of Alaska is also one of our longtime strategic partners, and we want to express our many thanks to the state for their collaboration and support of our work. Seated next to Robbie is Gary Sloshberg. Gary is the Vice President and Senior Economist for Wells Fargo Capital Management. He's traveled here from California to be one of our speakers today. And next to Gary is Joe Everhart, President of Wells Fargo Bank here in Alaska. On my far left is Steve Hatter. Steve is the Deputy Commissioner of Aviation with the State of Alaska's Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And the Alaska International Airport System, I'll say again, is also a sponsor of today's event, and we appreciate that. Next to Steve is Deantha Crockett, the Executive Director of Alaska Miners Association. Sitting next to Deantha is, of course, Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan. And finally, next to the mayor is Pat Burden, the president of Northern Economics. And Pat will be making the 2013 statewide forecast in a few minutes. We're going to start off with the national and international picture. To do so, giving us the outlook is Gary Sloshberg, who Joe just mentioned. This is his third time joining us, coming up from California. He knows how exciting Alaska can be. He was stuck with us on one of our trips to Juneau. So he knows the sort of environment that we have here. In any case, Gary is the Vice President and a Senior Economist with Wells Capital Management. He analyzes the economic and investment environment for that organization, which is a fee-based institutional money manager with over $330 billion in assets under management, as well as for the other investment in groups within Wells Fargo and Company. So in that capacity, he participates in conference calls to the organization's investment managers and salespeople throughout the country. He's a member of their investment policy committee and liquidity management strategy. Where I first came across Gary was on CNBC, watching him on television give the economic outlook. He's also appeared on Bloomberg, CNBC Asia, and his work has appeared in the Wall Street Journal and a lot of the other major financial media. Before he's has a 27-year career with Wells, been in the financial industry for 30 years. Prior to joining the bank, he was a researcher at the U.S. Treasury and Federal Reserve Board, covering international economic conditions. Please join me in welcoming back to Anchorage and to this event, Gary Schlossberg.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be back here. I think it's been a couple of years since I last spoke up in Anchorage, and to say the least, a lot of water under the bridge, and maybe that's the wrong expression in view of the weather that you had a couple of weeks ago, but a lot of changes. I must say, in keeping with this idea that economics is a dismal science, many of us haven't been busier have been at our busiest, I think, since the financial markets blew up back in 2008 and 2009. I think what I'd like to do today, and hopefully it'll be a segue to what Pat has to say on the Alaska economy. We compared notes, and I don't think I'll be throwing him off too much. Give you an overview of our thinking on the global economy, the U.S. economy, some of the near-term and long-term economic issues. Try to keep it as tight as I can, which is a challenge for me. When I get up here at times, I think I'm being paid by the word. But try to keep it brief and then turn it over to Pat for the real meat of the discussion, I think, the comments on the Alaska economy. In characterizing the current situation, I think it's safe to say that many of us feel cautiously optimistic. There are a couple of things going on, a lot of challenges that we seem to be sidestepping at the moment. The economy for the fourth straight year, starting off the year on an upbeat note, but certainly some challenges ahead. We are in the middle of an adjustment to the aftershocks from the financial meltdown. The housing market in the lower 48, at least, is on its way to recovery. The economic growth cycle is being led by the improvement in housing. The overhang of household debt, which weighed on consumers a few years ago, has been worked off. Debt burdens are about as low as they've been in the last 10 years or so. The sense is that consumers are capable of borrowing to finance that consumer-led recovery. And as Joe mentioned, banks are lending. Many of the larger banks have been lending for some time now, Wells Fargo and a few other banks that managed to weather the financial crisis better than most other organizations have been on the leading edge of that. But generally speaking, the financial markets, still far from normal, are starting to see an improvement in the flow of credit, which is really the lifeblood for economic growth. And we certainly look for further improvement ahead, but we're seeing improvement there as well. Secondly, the situation in China is certainly improving, and that's of more than passing interest for Alaska, China being the most important trading partner for the state. Concerns about a hard landing, a severe recession, seem to be subsiding a bit as China embarks on a moderate economic growth recovery, nothing like it had 2 or 3 years ago, but on its way to improvement over the course of the year. Europe, the European debt crisis, we feel is, I guess the best way to describe it, is in a dormant stage. Certainly there's more work to be done, more austerity, structural reforms in Europe, but the Band-Aid has been placed over the problem. It's off the front pages as a result of the European Central Bank's willingness to pump as much money as needed to stave off another financial upheaval in Europe, and hopefully they will stay off the front pages during the balance of the year. Japan moving more aggressively to try to stimulate its own economy through more aggressive fiscal and monetary stimulus. Even the budget situation here in the U.S., which of course is the most imminent, the most visible danger facing the U.S. at the moment, we've managed to sidestep the first of several chapters as well. There are challenges as we move through the year. Fundamentally, they fall into two categories. One has to do with the growing importance of things international on the global economy. For starters, the U.S. is increasingly dependent on international trends. We're becoming more and more open over time. Our dependence on export growth to finance overall economic growth has grown dramatically over the last 5 or 6 years. A lot of that has had to do with the weak growth in the domestic economy, but even predating the upheavals in the financial market back in 2008 and 2009, exports were accounting for a larger share of economic growth. Secondly, the emerging markets, because of their rapid growth, have taken up a growing share of the global economy. At this point, the emerging markets account for over 50% of world economic activity. And that's important for the U.S. as well, because we're no longer the big kid on the block. Historically, we've been the main driver of commodity prices. We've set the tone for global economic growth, typically on the leading edge of the upswings and recessions that the global economy has experienced over the last couple of decades. Well, we've seen some changes, and that was most noticeable about a year or so ago. The U.S. was going through an economic slowdown early in 2011. Normally, that would be associated with weakness in commodity prices. But because of the strength of China and some of the other emerging markets, commodity prices actually continued to move higher. And that simply aggravated the slowdown in the U.S. Emerging markets are a dynamic area. They open up plenty of opportunity for our multinationals, our export-oriented firms. But they, too, tend to be a bit more volatile and raise new uncertainties in the global economy. Third, as we saw in the wake of the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, and again with the flooding in Thailand, an increasingly integrated global economy has become even more so at an accelerated rate over the last few years. Supply chains between intermediate raw materials, intermediate goods, and finished products, and the end users have become increasingly tight, more focused, and increasingly integrated. And we've seen how a disruption in one part of the world can have serious ramifications for economic activity here and in other parts of the world as well. And finally, international is raising issues because many of the disturbances we've seen over the last 5 years have really struck at the heart of the global financial system. First, the upheaval in the United States, the dollar being the linchpin, the key currency in world trade and finance, and then the aftershocks, the ripple effect, through Europe, the other major partner, accounting for a major share of global trade and finance as well, weighing on the global economy. International and the importance of international is not unusual for Alaska. Alaska is typically, historically, has been one of the more open trade-oriented economies in the world. I don't know how well this chart shows up, but it's basically a scatter diagram designed to illustrate Alaska's importance or international trade's importance to the Alaska economy. The horizontal line simply shows exports as a share of GDP. And you can see that Alaska is pretty much in the middle of the pack. About 10% of the state's GDP comes from exports. Nothing extraordinary there. But international's impact on Alaska really extends far beyond that. Trade services beyond merchandise, investment flows certainly have a global dimension to them and influence the state's economic activity. Most importantly, because Alaska is a commodity producer, commodity prices have a major effect on the state's economy over and above the share of exports. Nowhere is that more apparent in the case of oil. Most of Alaska's oil goes to the rest of the country, the lower 48. But oil prices are determined globally. And because of fluctuations in the oil prices globally, that has more of an effect, a disproportionate effect on Alaska's economy than it has on most other parts of the U.S. That vertical line is designed to show the portion of economic activity, fluctuations in economic activity, that are due to conditions outside of the U.S. And you can see that while Alaska's in the middle of the pack in terms of exports as a share of state GDP, things international rank Alaska third. In other words, Alaska's the third most dependent on fluctuations in the global economy. The second area, the challenge that we face in 2013, has to do with economic policy, moving away from the international side. One area that we're closely monitoring that could have an international dimension is the effect of quantitative easing, not only by the Federal Reserve, but also other central banks, simply monetizing government debt, pumping money into the financial markets in an effort to inflate economies. The risk there is that in pumping money in, that depresses exchange rates. And that's fine for the country that's doing it. In fact, Japan has expressly said that its quantitative easing will be designed, more aggressive easing, will be designed to drive the Japanese yen down, improve competitiveness, and help drive an export-dependent economy higher. Elsewhere, though, it can have the effect of driving exchange rates lower. We've seen evidence of that with the dollar moving down from quantitative easing and the reaction of some emerging markets. The risk there is that if competitiveness of our trading partners is undermined, they become increasingly pressured to try to control those trade flows through trade controls directly, through capital controls, which weigh on the global economy and undermine world economic growth as well. In Europe, at the moment, as I said, the euro debt crisis is dormant because of actions by the European Central Bank. Still a lot of work to be done. Austerity has to continue. Structural reforms have to be made. But political changes can disrupt that, and there are important elections in Europe that can sidetrack those efforts and rekindle the euro debt problem during the balance of the year. Japan's fiscal stimulus designed to boost economic growth can weigh on the economy as well by adding to debt, undermining financial stability in the country, by heightening concern about an extraordinary debt load. Important leadership changes in China taking place, fundamentally an effort to try to redirect economic growth from being export and investment-led to being driven more by domestic economic activity, consumer-led economic growth. There are many facets to that, urbanization, wages, which are already going up and boosting consumer spending. But that can have the effect of tempering growth as well, as consumer spending typically grows less rapidly than investments and exports. As I said, the most immediate and most visible challenge to the U.S. has to do with the budget. We did get by the fiscal cliff, but there are still many chapters ahead, most of which will unfold, I suppose, during the first half of the year. The fiscal cliff itself is really made up of several parts. We've gone through the tax changes, and I'll get into that in a moment, but there's still the possibility of cuts in government spending, sequestration, which could take effect as early as the beginning of March. We have the looming debt ceiling increase, U.S. bumping up against the existing debt ceiling as early as late February. The betting at this point is that Congress will pass a temporary increase extending into April, but a source of uncertainty. The continuing resolution, Congress in the current fiscal year passed a spending resolution, which only got us through March. They have to address that issue once again at the risk of shutting down the government if spending doesn't continue to flow. And then we have the long-term deficit reduction, a grand bargain to try to reduce the deficit over the next 10 years. The sense is that they'll move slowly, but the credit rating agencies have already put the government on record as saying, or the credit rating agencies on record as saying that they will downgrade U.S. Credit rating if progress in that area isn't forthcoming. The budget is the overriding issue at the moment, as I said. Even though we've gotten by with an agreement on the fiscal cliff, the tax increases associated with that agreement could cause more damage than the apprehension in the run-up to that agreement itself at the end of the year. We are left with fiscal drag greater than ten times in the last 73 years have we seen tax increases and spending cuts greater, dragging, weighing on the economy than what we expect to see during the early part of 2013. We do expect to see growth slow as a result of that. The tax increases, the payroll tax increase, and the tax increase for upper income families. How much the economy slows really will depend on what else is going on, and that's where the good news comes in. There are a number of tailwinds out there which we think will cushion the effect on the economy during the early part of the year, hopefully set the stage for somewhat stronger growth as we move through the latter part of 2013. For one thing, much of the strength in the economy at the moment, the national economy, centers on housing and autos. High multiple sectors, they have a big ripple effect on other parts of the economy and are providing much of the lift that we've been seeing of late. Secondly, the recovery in the housing market, rising home values, rising stock prices are lifting household wealth, adding to household spending power, underpinning the consumer-led recovery that we're seeing now, as moderate as it is. Fuel prices have come down from their peak last summer, acting as something of a stealth tax cut, if you will, freeing up income for other goods and services spending. Businesses, cautious ahead of the fiscal cliff, pull back on investment spending. Investment spending late last year was simply too weak relative to other parts of the economy, and we expect to see some release of that as some of these budget issues begin to clear, as we think they will by around the middle of the year. And on top of that, of course, China, slowly recovering, as I said, and that provides a lift not only to the U.S., particularly Alaska, but other parts of the U.S., given the importance of China as an export market, but also the global economy, because China now has become an increasingly important engine for global economic growth. So all in all, we look for a relatively moderate first half of the year in terms of economic growth, picking up speed, nothing spectacular, no boom by any means, still fairly moderate by historic standards. The downside to that is the threat to interest rates. We look for a more unsettled interest rate environment. I would say the bias is probably going to be on the upside, starting with the idea that interest rates at the moment are artificially low. They're simply too low relative to the economy's underlying tone and the outlook for inflation. Put it in perspective, most Treasury interest rates are still lower now than they were at the worst of the financial crisis back in 2008, when the economy was in a free fall and there was concern about deflation, prices dropping. The economy hasn't performed spectacularly, but the fact that we're growing and inflation is, even at a moderate rate, prices are rising, you would expect to see higher rates. They've been kept down by a combination of flight capital, all the disturbances in Europe, concern about the budget here in the U.S., ironically better benefiting the Treasury market, and by strong purchases, heavy purchases of government debt by the Federal Reserve, artificially inflating demand. Well, Europe is calm for now. We expect to see the U.S. navigate some of these budget issues as we move through the first half of the year, removing another source of flight capital. At the same time, if the economy begins to improve during the latter part of the year, we think that interest rates could begin to recouple with a firming economy. The one barrier is very aggressive purchases by the Federal Reserve. And the risk there is that in an improving economy, you have the unintended consequence of rates moving up because of concern about all the money being pumped into the financial markets by the Federal Reserve. That's just what happened during quantitative easing QE2 back in 2011, when the Fed was buying up debt, pumping money into the system, driving commodity prices up, raising inflation expectations, and driving interest rates up with them. So we're not looking for a big run-up in interest rates, but we think that those rates could move modestly higher during the latter part of the year. Longer-term issues, as I said, the economy isn't performing spectacularly. We think it will continue to be restrained, even as growth continues into 2014, by a number of restraints. Even as we recover from the fallout from the financial meltdown, the markets are still healing. We don't expect to see a full normalized flow of credit for several more years. Pockets of the economy, small businesses to some extent, other parts of the economy, the private mortgage area, still pretty much restrained as the financial markets slowly recover. Consumers, we think, will be coming back moderately as well, even though their debt burdens are reduced. The healing is progressing, but it's not complete at this point. Pent-up demand for consumer goods. We're 4 years into an economic growth cycle. This recovery is a mature one, even though it's been a moderate one. Pent-up demand is greater than what we normally see in this cycle, but it is still down from where it was a year, 2 years ago, and that will act as a restraint as well. And more fundamentally, a couple of issues out there. The global economy is very competitive, far more competitive than it was, say, 20, 30 years ago when inflation last took off. Low-cost producers, weak unions, less regulation, easier entry into markets, all these things have undercut business pricing power, making it more difficult to raise prices to maintain margins, forcing businesses to focus more on cost restraint, which means that hiring and wage increases, while they will continue, will be more moderate than what they would be otherwise. The problem with that is that that's the raw material for household income growth. And as household incomes grow more moderately, it means that consumer spending, while growing, will be more moderate than what we would have expected. And finally, we think there is a fundamental mismatch in the labor market. Difficult to tell the extent of it at the moment because of the fallout from the very deep recession. But the fact is that job openings continue to grow at more than double, maybe three times the rate of actual hiring, an indication that job openings keyed toward more skilled professions are being unmet by the large pool of less skilled labor. And that means that jobs may not open quite as quickly or employment growth rise quite as quickly as what we would have expected in previous cycles. Longer-term challenges, some other risks, there are plenty of them. I'm not going to go through all of them. I have a feeling I'm overstaying my visit at this point, but you can see some of these challenges out there. Europe still making a difficult transition from welfare capitalism, trying to become more competitive. The way to achieve that is structural reform, very difficult politically and socially. The process will take a while. Low inflation has created these asset bubbles, rolling asset bubbles, which we think will continue, posing a threat to financial market stability. We're seeing it in farmland now. We saw it in housing 5-6 years ago, stock market in the late 1990s. Simply a lot of cash out there as the central bank tries to jumpstart the economy and inflation stays relatively low. The Fed unwinding its inflated balance sheet. As quantitative easing comes to an end, the concern that that will add to some stability in the market, overreactions, and volatility in interest rates, the risk of a tilt toward capital controls in emerging markets, if our exchange rate and those of other developed countries continue to move lower, and the transition from the commodity supercycle. Prices exploded a few years ago. And as we move toward a better balance in the commodity market, we can expect to see more volatility and more modest increases in prices going forward, although those increases should continue. The global rebalancing, though, the good news is that we are seeing that rebalancing in the global economy. As I mentioned earlier, the U.S. is already making a transition away from a consumer-based economy toward one more geared toward exports, investments, kind of the mirror image of China, which is rotating from investment and export-led growth to consumer-led growth. And in that, new opportunities, not only for Alaska, but for the U.S. as a whole in these expanding markets. We've seen it already with our multinationals. They're very competitive. And we expect to see more of that as China and other countries, particularly in Asia and Latin America, East Europe, continue to grow at an above-average rate. The U.S., we think, has a number of advantages here. As I said, our multinationals are very competitive in the global economy. On top of that, we remain on the leading edge of innovation, the latest evidence of that, of course, in the energy area. Entrepreneurship, more highly valued, access to venture capital, the whole culture of entrepreneurship, certainly more friendly here in the U.S. than it is in other parts of the world. And innovation is critical in a very competitive global economy. And then finally, the implications of increased energy output, not only in terms of the output, the sales overseas, businesses coming back, energy-intensive industries coming back to the Gulf area. We're already seeing evidence of that. The comparative advantage of relatively low-cost energy as well. The ramifications, though, extend beyond that into the financial area. As our trade balance narrows a bit, and begins to improve as a result of increased energy exports and reduced imports, the dollar should hold up better in the currency markets. Like a lot of other things in economics, a double-edged sword poses more of a challenge for U.S. firms competing in the global economy, but at the same time, it means that the move away from the dollar as a key currency in world trade and finance should be slowed. The pace of that diversification has varied with the weakness in the dollar over the last 10 or 15 years. And if the dollar is holding up better because of that energy strength, the improved energy balance, we think that our position as the key currency in world trade and finance and the advantages that go with that in financing deficits and financing our capital requirements should continue to grow commensurate with that. For Alaska, the opportunities we think in the trade area will continue to be enormous. As I said, commodity prices we think will continue to move higher, just not as rapidly as they did early in the super boom in commodities about 10 years ago following a period of relative weakness. The balance between most materials, including oil, and between supply and demand remain fairly tight. As the economy grows, we would expect to see those prices move up. We have a window to the most dynamic area of the world, Asia. Within Asia, important changes taking place. Greater exports outside of China as China's costs begin to rise. But within China itself, opportunities as well as they rotate more toward a consumer-driven economy and away from exports and investment. And that's important because as their living standards improve, Many of the things that Alaska sells, notably seafood, much like California exports, tend to be income sensitive. They rise with improving living standards. That, coupled with the effort in Japan to jumpstart their economy, should open up opportunities in the next few years as well. Pat will tell you more about the Alaska economy itself, but the trade opportunities for an area that already is very trade-oriented, we think, are quite bright, keeping Alaska, we think, on the leading edge of economic growth, not only in 2013, but beyond. Thank you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Vice President and Senior Economist of Wells Capital Management, Gary Sloshberg. He was recorded on January 22nd at the Statewide Economic Forecast Luncheon hosted by the World Trade Center of Alaska. Following Mr. Sloshberg's national and international economic update, President and Principal Economist of Northern Economics, Patrick Burden, took the stage to present the Statewide Economic Review and 2013 Forecast.
And now for the 2013 statewide forecast, I'd like to introduce Pat Burden. Pat is the president and principal economist for Northern Economics, a company that he founded 30 years ago. Northern Economics specializes in developing practical cost-effect solutions for their clients in a variety of industries, a variety of economic areas, including economic planning, transportation planning, the oil and gas sector, municipal projects, international development, resource economy, economics, maritime planning, fishing industry projects, and a host of others. His company does work not only in Alaska, of course, but in the lower 48 and markets overseas. Pat and his firm have been involved with this forecast now for the 10th straight year, and we always listen very closely because their forecast has been pretty darn accurate. So with that, I'll introduce Pat Burden from Northern Economics.
And I just want to say thanks, everyone, for being here. This, again, as Greg said, this is the 10th year, and it's been a lot of fun putting these on. We've learned a lot over the years as we've worked on making our models better. And it's been a real pleasure to put these on with Greg and his staff. We're going to just go quickly and look at the economic outlook for 2013 and the forecast. Is it a partly cloudy day or is it a partly sunny day? What do you think? So it's really partly cloudy or partly sunny, depending on your view. Okay, we heard Gary talk about the national economy and the fact that it was getting better, and we'll talk about a bit of that a bit today. I just want to say that, you know, Alaska is not, we think of ourselves as being really distinct and different, but we are not separated totally from the national economy. Anyone who was here in 2009 will remember that the local economy was doing pretty good, but a lot of the companies that were, you know, they were branches or subsidiaries or affiliates of companies in the lower 48 were cutting back and not spending, just because although their operations were doing well, the overall company in the lower 48 was not doing well, and they had to cut back on the spending and the hiring that they were doing in Alaska. So we need to be cognizant of what the national economy is doing if we're going to be talking about a forecast for Alaska. And Alaska's economy is increasing at the growth rate of our population. You know, as Mayor Sullivan said, this is the 10th year that people have come here to hear that we're going to grow at about 1% a year. Well, not quite. We've changed the numbers a few times than that, but really it's been a pretty stable growth pattern for a number of years in the state's economy. But as Gary indicated, and we know from our own presence here in the state and reading the newspapers and listening to the TV, that both the national and the state economy have some significant near-term challenges that we'll be facing, and we'll talk about those here. Well, this slide really talks about employment and the national economy, and are we back yet? And we're still about 3% below the employment levels that were reached in 2006-07. So we still have a ways to go For those who were here in 2009 at the luncheon, you'll remember us talking the fact that this was the first financial-led crisis or recession that the nation had experienced since the Great Depression. And it was going to take possibly as long as 10 years for us to recover back to those levels. Well, you know, the recession formally started in December of 2007, so we're now 5 years into it. And this slide shows that we still have some years to go before we'll be back to employment levels that we had prior to the crash. Gary talked about the fact of consumer-led spending and what that means for the national economy, and these two slides really show what's happening for consumers. The slide on the left shows monthly rent versus monthly mortgage payments, and the mortgage payments are the blue line that peaked it back in 2007. And the monthly mortgage payments that people are making now are half the level of what they were making back in 2007. Housing prices have dropped, and we also have lower interest rates, which makes housing more affordable. So, you know, that's really a positive for the national economy. The slide on the right shows household debt service ratio. In other words, you know, it's what portion of household income is going to debt. And you notice it's at multi-decade lows. The consumer has really delevered their balance sheet from what it was in 2007 down to something that's really, really supportable. And it means that when this economy takes off, the consumer is going to be leading that spending again. We also have another leg of the stool, which is industry or business. The slide on the left shows the after-tax corporate profits as a percent of GDP, and you'll notice that it's 50% higher than the 50-year average. Businesses have a lot of money on their balance sheets. The slide on the right shows the leverage of businesses, and it shows that, again, businesses have delevered and they have much lower debt ratios than they've had for decades. So it's multi-decade lows, actually. So we're really looking at two legs of the three-legged stool being poised to take off and jump. But then we have government. It's really holding us back at this point. You know, federal government is cutting the budget. They're laying people off. State governments in the lower 48, local governments in the lower 48 are doing the same thing. They're facing really tight budgets and they're having to cut in the face of they can't do like the national government does and go to deficit spending. They have to balance their budget. So it means that people are being laid off and they're cutting spending. But when the economy really tanked, government had to step up and really kind of try to fill the hole to some extent, and that's what was done. And that's what you do if you're, you know, the current administration. But what we see now is that we need to cut the spending at the government level. This is the federal government outlays and receipts on the right. We need to cut the spending, and we need to raise taxes to generate more income. They need to balance somewhere in the middle between those two dotted lines that you see, so someplace between 18 and 20%. That would get us back into a reasonable range. So just a quick discussion here about where your federal income taxes went, and where would you cut? We have Medicare, military is on the far right, then we have Medicare, then we have interest on debt, and then we have Social Security. And those four items sum up to about 80% of the total budget. So, you know, we can cut some places, but a lot of the smaller discretionary pieces don't matter. They aren't big enough to make a difference, even if we eliminated them. Well, let's talk about Alaska. You know, last year we talked about an object in motion stays in motion. We were just kind of chugging along like a train does, and staying in you know, relatively slow growth economy. And if we go back and look at our prediction for the gross state product, we predicted GSP would be roughly flat at $51 billion. In what actually happened was government spending happened at a higher level than we thought because of their still response to the crash, and sustained oil prices. Oil prices stayed up higher than we thought that they would, and it pushed GSP to a record $53 billion. And construction also bounced back from a combination of federal and state spending. We also have this bond issue that was passed, which will be, you know, pushing construction forward in this coming year. In 2012, we also looked at jobs. We thought about a moderate job growth, 1.3%. In reality, it turned out to be 1.6%, led by health and education, which has been leading for a number of years now, finance and other services, and natural resources. And when we talk about natural resources, I should point out that what we're talking about here are oil and gas, we're talking about mining, and we're talking about the seafood industry. So oil and gas, of course, really contributes strongly to the gross state product of the state. It, on the other end, the seafood industry really contributes to the employment side of the equation. So for those who haven't been here before, that kind of gives you an idea of what's in what we call the super sector of natural resources. One of the primary drivers of the state's economy is oil production, and it continues downward. It hasn't gone up, and we're looking at facing continued declines in the fields up on the North Slope. However, if we look at around the nation, other states, other players are shifting their curves from going down to turning around. Texas is from 2002 to 2012. Texas has increased their oil production by 60%. North Dakota, of course, has gone 600%. California is down, Louisiana is down, but if you look closely at those graphs for California and Louisiana, you'll notice that their curves have flattened. So they've been able to stabilize their production levels. Alaska continues to go down, decline. So, the shale oil plays in the lower 48 have been a real boom for some states, and we can hope that Great Bear is successful in their venture up on the North Slope. One other potential kink in the armor for Alaska is the circle that we put up there is the West Texas Intermediate. This is an index that's often used for oil prices in the lower 48, and it reflects, oil prices in the middle of the continent, lower 48. It's actually Cushing, Oklahoma. And the red circle shows the prices for Brent, which is a kind of an index for global crude oil prices, and ANS, which really tracks it, Alaska North Slope on the West Coast. What we see is that since about 2010, ANS and Brent have been priced above WTI, West Texas Intermediate. And the reason for that is because of the glut of oil that's developed from the Bakken, the Eagle Ford, and the Permian basins in the mid-continent. Those have really created a glut of oil in the mid-continent, and we're seeing that the prices have disassociated, they've separated. Now, the spread, as they talk about it, has narrowed from more than $20 to about $16 as of this morning. So it's narrowed a bit because there's a new pipeline that just reversed and started flowing more oil from Cushing, Oklahoma into Houston and the Gulf Coast. And so that spread has narrowed. Now, some analysts believe that what's going to happen is that the price of WTI will go up to match the Brent. Others believe that what's going to happen is the oil that's moving from Oklahoma to the Gulf Coast will displace all of the imports that come in from Nigeria and other locations, the sweet oil, and that then the WTI will start putting pressure on what's called Louisiana sweet, which is another oil that's produced in the Gulf Coast area. If we look at ANS prices, ANS oil, it's similar situation to what could happen with LLS. So we could see potential displacement of the oil is imported from foreign countries into the west coast of the U.S. So oil from the continent displaces that first and then starts putting pressure on ANS prices. There's differences of opinions between the analysts as to what's going to happen, but it is a potential for us to see ANS prices drop from where they are and their linkage to Brent at this point. The reason that ANS is priced at Brent prices is because the marginal price that goes into the West Coast is imported crude. So everybody raises their price to be at that or just underneath it so that they can sell into the market. So, you know, we're seeing a potential for ANS prices to drop and disassociate from Brent. It's really going to be a matter of how much rail capacity and pipeline capacity people will start using to move oil from the middle of the U.S. and Western Canada to the coast. I mean, Tesoro is a major refiner in Puget Sound, and they announced plans to develop a unit train to bring oil from North Dakota to Puget Sound and Anacortes. So that's a potential for people to start, the refiners to really start moving that oil and really trying to improve their margins and their profits. And at the same time, we have a revenue gap that's potentially unfolding. This is from Scott Goldsmith, a recent ICER report. He thinks that we'll have start eating our cash reserves this year, and that's really a function of what the legislature does, but it's something for us to think about is we may not be in a surplus situation anymore. We may be at a point where we have to start using the budget reserves that we've built up over the years. And, you know, Scott thinks that our budget should be about $5.5 billion to be sustainable, which would mean that we'd have to cut about $1.5 billion, which would be a pretty severe cut. Especially since a lot of the growth that we've been seeing and, you know, the construction industry grew last year is really based upon some state spending that's above trend for the past, you know, 10 years. So if we had to cut 18 to 28 cents out of the state's budget, where could we go? Well, the capital budget is probably the easiest place to cut. I remember yours and probably people here too, where the total capital budget was $250 million. So it could be cut pretty dramatically, pretty quickly. So let's get on to 2013. Instructions for whoever's driving is coast down the road and hope it doesn't end over that hill, the next hill. So again, we're looking at continued mild growth with increasing uncertainty about as we go out further. That's typical of any forecast. We're seeing continued growth for natural resources and mining, education and healthcare services. So natural resources and mining, again, that's oil and gas and mining and the seafood industry, really important super sector for the state's economy. And education and healthcare, it's primarily healthcare because the education here is private education. Normal education is in the government sector. So healthcare services have been a growth engine in the state for more than a decade. It continues as a growth industry, and we'll see that happening. As mentioned earlier, the state capital projects budget is supporting much of the current growth in the construction industry and related sectors. The bond issue that the state voters passed recently will support construction through next year and possibly into the year after that. It depends upon what the legislature does in terms of either using the surplus funds that we have in the budget or cutting the capital budget as to what happens when we go beyond that. You know, we're fighting headwinds from declining oil production, reduced federal spending. We've already seen layoffs there and cutbacks in hiring. Low growth in the national economy, and as I indicated before, we are not separate from the national economy. And, of course, we have what's going on in Congress and with the administration trying to deal with fiscal cliffs and its other items. So the gross state product by sector, we're saying it grows slightly, but still at $53 billion. If you look at the numbers, you'll see that some of the sectors are supposed to grow fairly readily, but again, the oil and gas industry really contributes a significant amount to the state's GSP. And with declining oil production, and we're looking for prices to be about flat from where they were this past year, it's a decline in the gross contribution of natural resources to the gross state product. Gainers are finance and other industry and construction and manufacturing. They should do well. In manufacturing, really, when we talk about manufacturing, what we're talking about is the seafood industry again, and mostly seafood processing. It accounts for the majority of manufacturing in the state. So the total change is, you know, about 0.1%. So it's within the range of error is what we're saying. One item, if we look at this trend in the gross state product, is that what we're forecasting is pretty flat. But if you look, the trend in that gross state product is flatter after the recession than it was before. We don't know if that is a permanent trend, permanent shift, or whether we'll start taking up, going up more, or going down when we look out a few more years. When we talk about employment, we talk Northern Economics, we're talking about employment that's comparable to a measure that's used by the Bureau of Economic Activity, which includes the military and it includes the self-employed. So there are differences between the numbers that you'll hear from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development and from what we provide because of those differences. And you can see the difference here for the 2012 data. So for 2013, total employment increases to 466,000, roughly. It's a total change of about 5,600 jobs, which is about 1.3%. But you know, 5,600 jobs is not insignificant. It's a fair number of people. You know, recent graduates out of high school and colleges, people who are migrating in from elsewhere out of the state, who will be taking those jobs. The big lead sector is, of course, health and education. It has been for a decade or more. Construction and the manufacturing will also be doing well this year with the bond issue and other funds that have been going into the construction sector. And natural resources will be up some. Finance and other services is going to be a boom for that sector. 1,200 jobs, 1.4%, but it's still decent. And then we have some minor. The government could be positive or negative. The models say it's plus 100, it could be negative 100, because what we're seeing is more cuts at the federal level and state and local governments balancing that. Transportation and utilities is the only sector we really think will be down modestly, but still it's down a bit. And this just kind of shows the ranking, again in the graphics, with health and education and construction being the highest percent sectors. Just a quick note on 2013 for Anchorage. This is from the State Department of Labor and Workforce Development, their Alaska trends. And it just kind of gives you what their forecast was for statewide and the municipality of Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Southeast. And generally, the department thinks that the growth in Anchorage will be in line with the state forecasts. Modest gains. Government, they expect to be down in the municipality, primarily because of losses at the federal level again. So, and with that, we'll call it good. So thank you very much for the opportunity to be here again.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with President and Principal Economist of Northern Economics, Patrick Burden. He presented the Statewide Economic Review and 2013 Forecast at the Statewide Economic Forecast Luncheon hosted by the World Trade Center of Alaska. Before Mr. Burden, you heard from the Vice President and Senior Economist of Wells Capital Management, Gary Sloshberg, who gave the national and international economic update. The Statewide Economic Forecast Luncheon, hosted by the World Trade Center of Alaska, was recorded at the Hilton Anchorage on January 22, 2013. Next week on Addressing Alaskans, Doll Sheep on the Decline, Understanding Sheep Population Dynamics. Recorded at the Alaska Zoo Wildlife Wednesday Lecture Series, hear from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Doll Sheep Biologist, Dr. Tom Loheis. That's coming up next week. Also, mark your calendars for Tuesday, February 19th, when Addressing Alaskans will move to Tuesday. Listen to Addressing Alaskans at the same time, 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. every Tuesday on KSKA, starting in a few weeks. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.